Lutza and Lobsang pass through Bong Phut and Long Nap like ghosts in twilight. People and animals were bluish statues and were not, said Lutza, to be touched in any circumstances. Lutza stocked his travel bag with more food from some of the houses, making sure to leave little copper tokens in their place. It means we're obliged to them, he said, filling Lobsang's bag as well. The next monk through here might have to give someone a minute or two. Well, a minute or two isn't much. For a dying woman to say goodbye to her children is a lifetime, said Lutza. Is it not written, every second counts? Let's go. I'm tired, Sweeper. I did say every second counts. But everybody has to sleep. Yes, but not yet, Lutza insisted. We can rest in the caves down at Songset. Can't hold time while you're asleep, see? But can't we use these spinners? In theory, yes. In theory. They could wind out time for us. We'd only sleep for a few seconds. They're for emergencies only, said Lutza bluntly. How do you define an emergency, Sweeper? An emergency is when I decide it's time to use a clockwork spinner designed by Q, Wonder Boy. A life belt's for saving your life. That's when I'll trust an uncalibrated, unblessed spinner powered by springs, when I have to. I know, Q says. Lobsang blinked and shook his head. Lutza grabbed his arm. You felt something again? Like having a tooth out in my brain, said Lobsang, rubbing his head. He pointed. It came from over there. A pain came from over there, said Lutza. He glared at the boy. But we've never found a way of detecting which way. He stopped and rummaged in his sack. Then he used the sack to sweep snow off a flat boulder. We'll see what... Glass House. This time, Lobsang could concentrate on the tones that filled the air. Wet finger on a wine glass? Well, you could start there. But the finger would have to be finger of a god, on the glass of some celestial sphere. And the wonderful, complex, shifting tones did not simply fill the air. They were the air. The moving blur beyond the walls was getting closer now. It was just beyond the closest wall, then found the open doorway and vanished. Something was behind Lobsang. He turned. There was nothing there that he could see, but he felt movement and, for just a moment, something warm brushed his cheek. The sand says, said Lutza, tipping a small bag onto the rock. The coloured grains bounced and spread. They did not have the sensitivity of the mandala itself, but there was a blue bloom in the chaos. He gave Lobsang a sharp look. It has been proved that no one can do what you just did, he said. We never found any way of detecting where a disturbance in time is actually being caused. Sorry. Lobsang raised a hand to his cheek. It was damp. What did I do? It takes a huge... Lutza stopped. Ankh more porks that way, he said. Did you know that? No. Anyway, you said you had a feeling things would happen in Ankh more pork. Yes, but I've had a lifetime of experience and cynicism. Lutza scooped the sand back into his bag. You're just gifted. Come on. 4 more seconds, sliced thinly, took them below the snow line, into scree slopes that slid under their feet, and then through alder forests not much taller than themselves. And it was there they met the hunters, gathered round in a wide circle. The men did not pay them much attention. Monks were commonplace in these parts. The leader, or at least the one who was shouting, and this is usually the leader, did look up and waved them past. Lutza stopped, though, and looked amiably at the thing in the centre of the circle. It looked back at him. Good catch, he said. What are you going to do now, boys? Is it any business of yours? Said the leader. No, just asking, said Lutza. You boys up from the lowlands, yes? Yeah. You'll be amazed at what you can get for catching one of these. Yes, said Lutza. You would be amazed. Lobsang looked at the hunters. There was more than a dozen of them, all heavily armed and watching Lutza carefully. $900 for a good pelt, and another 1,000 for the feet. said the leader. That much, eh? Said Lutzer. That's a lot of money for a pair of feet.
That's 'cause they're big feet, said the hunter. And you know what they say about men with big feet, eh?
They need bigger shoes?
Yeah, right, said the hunter, grinning. Load of nonsense, really. But there's rich old boys with young wives over there on the counterweight continent who'll pay a fortune for a powdered yeti foot.
And there was me thinking they're a protected species, said Lutzer, leaning his broom against a tree.
They're only a kind of troll. Who's going to protect them out here? Said the hunter.
Behind him, the local guides, who did know Rule One, turned and ran.
Me, said Lutzer. Oh,
said the hunter, and this time the grin was nasty.
You don't even have a weapon.
He turned to look at the fleeing guides.
You're one of the weird monks from up in the valleys, aren't you?
That's right, said Lutzer.
Small, grinning, weird monk, totally unarmed. And there's 15 of us, said the hunter, well armed, as you can see.
It's very important that you're all heavily armed, said Lutzer, pulling his sleeves out of the way. It makes it fairer. He rubbed his hands together. No one seemed inclined to retreat.
Any of you boys heard of any rules? He said after a while.
Rules? Said one of the hunters. What rules?
Oh, you know, said Lutzer. Rules like Rule 2, or, say, Rule 27. Any kind of rules of that sort of description?
The leading hunter frowned.
What in damnation are you talking about, mister?
Not so much a mister as a small, rather knowing, elderly, entirely unarmed, weird monk, said Lutzer.
I'm just wondering if there isn't anything about this situation that makes you, you know, slightly nervous?
You mean us being well-armed and outnumbering you and you backing away like that?
Said one of the hunters.
Ah, yes, said Lutzer. Perhaps we're up against a cultural thing here. I know. How about this?
He stood on one leg, wobbling a little, and raised both hands.
Hi! Hi! Ho! Yee!
No? Anyone? There was a certain amount of bewilderment among the hunters.
Is it a book?
Said one who was slightly intellectual.
How many words?
What I'm trying to find out here,
said Lutzer,
is whether you have any idea what happens when a lot of big armed men try to attack a small, elderly, unarmed monk.
But to the best of my knowledge,
said the intellectual of the group, he turns out to be a very unlucky monk. Lutzer shrugged.
Oh, well, he said, then we'll just have to try it the hard way.
A blur in the air hit the intellectual on the back of the neck. The leader stirred to step forward and learned too late that his bootlaces were tied together. Men reached for knives that were no longer in sheaths, for swords that were inexplicably leaning against a tree on the far side of the clearing. Legs were swept from underneath them, invisible elbows connected with soft parts of their bodies. Blows rained out of empty air. Those who fell down learned to stay that way. A raised head hurt. The group was reduced to men lying humbly on the ground, groaning gently. It was then that they heard a low, rhythmic sound. The Yeti was clapping. It had to be a slow hand clap because of the creature's long arms. But when the hands met, they'd come a long way and were glad to see one another. They echoed around the mountains. Lutzer reached down and raised the leader's chin.
If you have enjoyed this afternoon, please tell your friends, he said. Tell them to remember Rule One.
He let the chin go and walked across to the Yeti and bowed.
Shall I release you, sir, or would you like to do it yourself? He said.
The Yeti stood up, looked down at the cruel iron trap around one leg, and concentrated for a moment. At the end of the moment, the Yeti was a little way from the trap, which was still set and almost hidden in leaves.
Well done, said Lutzer. Methodical and very smooth. Headed down to the lowlands.
The Yeti had to bend double to bring its long face close to Lutzer.
Yes,
it said. What do you want to do with these people? The Yeti looked around at the cowering hunters.
"It being dark soon," it said. "No guides, no."
"We've got torches," said Lutzer.
"Ha, ha,"
said the Yeti, and it said it rather than laughed.
"That's good. Torches show up at night."
"Ah, yes. Can you give us a lift? It's really important."
"You and that whizzing kid I see in there."
A patch of grey air at the edge of the clearing became Lobsang, out of breath. He dropped the broken branch he'd been holding.
"The lad is called Lobsang. I'm training him up," said Lutzer. "Looks like you gotta hurry before you running out of things he don't know," said the Yeti. "Har, har."
"Sweeper, what were you..."
Lobsang began, hurrying forward. Lutzer put his finger to his lips.
"Not in front of our fallen friends," he said.
"I'm looking for Rule 1 to become a lot better respected in these parts as a result of this day's work."
"But I had to do all that..."
"We must be going," said Lutzer, waving him into silence. "I reckon we can snooze quite happily while our friend here carries us." Lobsang glanced up at the Yeti and then back to Lutzer. And then back to the Yeti. It was tall. In some ways, it was like the trolls he'd met in the city, but rolled out thin. It was more than twice as high as he was, and most of the extra height was skinny legs and arms. The body was a ball of fur, and the feet were indeed huge.
"If he could have got out of the trap at any..."
he began.
"You are the apprentice, right?" said Lutzer.
"Me? I'm the master. I'm sure I wrote that down somewhere.
But you said you weren't going to say any of those know-it-all.
Remember Rule 1. Oh, and pick up one of those swords. We'll need it in a minute. Okay, Your Honor."
The Yeti picked them up gently and firmly, cradled them in the crook of each arm, and strode away through the snow and trees.
"Okay," said Lutzer after a while.
"Their wool is spun out of rock in some way, but it's pretty comfy."
There was no answer from the other arm.
"I spent some time with the Yetis," said Lutzer. "Amazing people. They taught me a thing or two, valuable stuff. Or is it not written, 'We live and learn'?"
Silence. A kind of sullen, deliberate silence reigned.
"I'd think myself lucky if I was a boy of your age, actually being carried by an actual Yeti. A lot of people back in the valley have never even seen one. Mind you, they don't come that close to settlements anymore. Not since that rumour about their feet got around."
Lutzer got the feeling that he was taking part in a dialogue of one.
"Something you want to say, is there?" he said.
"Well, as a matter of fact, yes, there is, actually," said Lobsang. "You let me do all the work back there. You weren't going to do anything."
"I was making sure I had their full attention," said Lutzer smoothly.
"Why?"
"So that you didn't have their full attention. I had every confidence in you, of course. A good master gives the pupil an opportunity to demonstrate his skills."
"And what would you have done if I hadn't been there, pray?"
"Yes, probably," said Lutzer.
"What?"
"But I expect I would have found some way to use their stupidity against them," said Lutzer. "There generally is. Is there a problem here?"
"Well, I just thought you'd be teaching me more, that's all."
"I'm teaching you things all the time," said Lutzer. "You might not be learning them, of course."
"Oh, I see," said Lobsang, very smug. "Are you going to try to teach me about this Yeti, then, and why you made me bring a sword?"
"Well, you'll need the sword to learn about Yetis," said Lutzer.
"How?"
"In a few minutes we'll find a nice place to stop, and you can cut his head off. Is that all right by you, sir?"
"Yes, sure," said the Yeti.
In the second scroll of When the Eternal is Surprised, a story is written concerning one day when the apprentice Clodpool, in a rebellious mood, approached When and spake thusly.
"Master, what is the difference between a humanistic, monastic system of belief in which wisdom is sought by means of an apparently nonsensical system of questions and answers, and a lot of mystic gibberish made up on the spur of the moment?"
When considered this for some time, and at last said, "A fish." And Clodpool went away, satisfied.
The code of the Igors was very strict. Never contradict. It was no part of an Igor's job to say things like, "No, sir, that's an artery." The master was always right. Never complain. An Igor would never say, "But that's 1,000 miles away." Never make personal remarks. No Igor would dream of saying anything like, "I should have something done about that loft if I were you." And never, ever ask questions. Admittedly, Igor knew that meant never ask big questions.
"Would sir like a cup of tea around now?"
was fine. But,
"What do you need 100 virgins for?"
or,
"Where do you expect me to find a brain at this time of night?"
was not. An Igor stood for loyal, dependable, discreet service with a smile, or at least a sort of lopsided grin, or possibly just a curved scar in the right place.
And it has to be said that there was nothing intrinsically evil about Igors themselves. They just didn't pass judgment on other people. Admittedly, that was because if you worked for werewolves and vampires and people who looked on surgery as modern art rather than science, passing judgment would mean you'd never have time to get anything done.
And, therefore, Igor was getting worried. Things were wrong, and when an Igor thinks that, they are really wrong. Great difficulty lay in getting this across to Jeremy without breaking the code, though. Igor was increasingly ill at ease with someone so clearly stark, daring, sane. Nevertheless, he tried.
"Her ladyship will be along again this morning," he said,
as they watched yet another crystal grow in its solution. "And I know you know that," he thought, "because you've smoothed your hair down with soap and put on a clean shirt."
"Yes," said Jeremy. "I wish we had better progress to report. However, I'm sure we're nearly there now."
"Yes, that's very strange, isn't it?"
said Igor, seizing the opening.
"Strange, you say?"
"Call me Mr. Philly, sir, but it always seems to me that we're always on the point of success when her ladyship pays us a visit. But when she's gone, we experience new difficulties."
"What are you suggesting, Igor?"
"Me, sir? I'm not a suggestive person, sir. But last time, part of the divider array had cracked."
"You know I think that was because of dimensional instability."
"Yes, sir."
"Why are you giving me that funny look, Igor?"
Igor shrugged. That is, one shoulder was momentarily as high as the other one.
"Goes with the face, sir."
"She'd hardly pay her so handsomely and then sabotage the project, would she? Why would she do that?"
Igor hesitated. He had his back right up against the code now.
"I am still wondering if she is all she seems, sir."
"Sorry, I didn't catch that."
"I wonder if we can trust her, sir,"
said Igor patiently.
"Oh, go and calibrate the complexity resonator, will you?"
Grumbling, Igor obeyed. The second time that he'd followed their benefactor, she'd gone to a hotel. Next day, she'd headed for a large house in King's Way, where she'd been met by an oily man who'd made a great play of presenting her with a key. Igor had followed the oleaginous man back to his office in a nearby street, where, because there are few things that are kept from a man with a face full of stitches, he'd learnt that she'd just bought the lease for a very large bar of gold. After that, Igor had resorted to an ancient Ankh-Morpork tradition and paid someone to follow her ladyship. There was enough gold in the workshops, heavens knew, and the master took no interest in it. Lady Lejean went to the opera. Lady Lejean went to art galleries. Lady Lejean was living life to the fullest. Except that Lady Lejean, as far as Igor could determine, never visited restaurants and had no food delivered to the house. Lady Lejean was up to something. Igor could spot this easily. Lady Lejean also did not appear in Twerp's Peerage, or the Almanach de Gothique, or any of the other reference books Igor had checked as a matter of course, which meant that she had something to hide. Of course, he had worked for masters who occasionally had a great deal to hide, sometimes in deep holes at midnight. But this situation was morally different for two reasons. Her ladyship wasn't his master, Jeremy was, and that was where his loyalty lay. And Igor had decided it was morally different. Now he reached the glass clock. It looked almost complete. Jeremy had designed a mechanism to go behind the face, and Igor had got it made up all in glass. It had nothing whatsoever to do with the other mechanism, which flickered away down behind the pendulum and took up a disconcertingly small amount of room now that it was assembled. Quite a few of its parts were no longer sharing the same set of dimensions as the rest of it. But the clock had a face, and a face needed hands, and so the glass pendulum swung and the glass hands moved and told normal everyday time. The tick had a slight bell-like quality, as though someone was flicking a wine glass with a fingernail. Igor looked at his hand-me-down hands. They were beginning to worry him. Now that the glass clock looked like a clock, they began to shake every time Igor came near it.
No one noticed Susan in the library of the Guild of Historians, leafing her way through a pile of books. Occasionally, she'd make a note. She didn't know if her other gift was from death, but she'd always told the children that they had a lazy eye and a business eye. There were two ways of looking at the world. The lazy eye just saw the surface. The business eye saw through into the reality beneath. She turned a page. Seen through her business eye, history was very strange indeed. The scars stood out. The history of the country of Ephebi was puzzling, for example. Either its famous philosophers lived for a very long time, or inherited their names, or extra bits had been stitched into history there. The history of Omnia was a mess. 2 centuries had been folded into one by the look of it, and it was only because of the mindset of the Omnians, whose religion mixed the past and future with the present, in any case, that it could possibly have passed unnoticed. And what about Coombe Valley? Everyone knew that there had been a famous battle there, between dwarfs and trolls and mercenaries on both sides. But how many battles had there actually been? Historians talked about the valley being in just the right place in disputed territory to become more or less the preferred local pitch for all confrontations. But you could just as easily believe, at least you could if you had a grandfather called Death, that a patch that just happened to fit had been welded into history several times, so that different generations went round through the whole stupid disaster again and again shouting, "Remember Coombe Valley," as they did so.
Every society needs a cry like that, but only in a very few do they come out with the complete unvarnished version, which is, "Remember the atrocity committed against us last time that will excuse the atrocity that we're about to commit today," and so on. Hurrah!
There were anomalies everywhere, and no one had noticed. You had to hand it to human beings. They had one of the strangest powers in the universe. Even her grandfather had remarked upon it. No other species anywhere in the world had invented boredom. Perhaps it was boredom, not intelligence, that had propelled them up the evolutionary ladder. Trolls and dwarves had it, too. That strange ability to look at the universe and think, "Oh, the same as yesterday. How dull. I wonder what happens if I bang this rock on that head." And along with this had come the contrary power, to make things normal. The world changed mightily, and within a few days humans considered it was normal. They had the most amazing ability to shut out and forget what didn't fit. They told themselves little stories to explain away the inexplicable, to make things normal. Historians were especially good at it. If it suddenly looked as though hardly anything had happened in the 14th century, they'd weigh in with 20 different theories. Not one of them would be that maybe most of the time had been cut out and pasted into the 19th century, where the crash had not left enough coherent time for everything that needed to happen, because it only takes a week to invent the horse collar. The history monks had done their job well, but their biggest ally was the human ability to think narratively. And humans had risen to the occasion. They'd say things like, "Thursday already? What happened to the week?" And, Time seems to go a lot faster these days. And it seems like only yesterday. But some things remained. The monks had carefully wiped out the time when the glass clock had struck. It had been surgically removed from history. Almost. Susan picked up Grimm fairy tales again. Her parents hadn't bought her books like this when she was a child. They'd tried to bring her up normally. They knew that it was not entirely a good idea for humans to be too close to death. They taught her that facts were more important than fancy. And then she'd grown up and found out that the real fantasies weren't the Pale Rider or the Tooth Fairy or Bogeyman. They were all solid facts. The big fantasy was that the world was a place where the toast didn't care if it came butter side down or not, where logic was sensible, and that things could be made not to have happened. Something like the glass clock had been too big to hide. It had leaked out via the dark, hidden labyrinths of the human mind and had become a folk tale. People had tried to coat it with sugar and magic swords, but its true nature still lurked, like a rake in an overgrown lawn, ready to rise up at the incautious foot. Now someone was treading on it again, and the point, the key point, was the chin it was rising to meet belonged to someone like me. She sat and stared at nothing for a while. Around her, historians climbed library ladders, fumbled books onto their lecterns, and generally rebuilt the image of the past to suit the eyesight of today. One of them was, in fact, looking for his glasses. Time had a son, she thought, someone who walks in the world. There was a man who devoted himself to the study of time so wholeheartedly that for him, time became real. He learned the ways of time, and time noticed him, death has said. There was something there like love. And time had a son. How? Susan had the kind of mind that would sour a narrative with a question like that. Time and a mortal man. How could they ever... Well, how could they? Then she thought, my grandfather is death. He adopted my mother. My father was his apprentice for a while. That's all that happened. They were both human, and I turned up in the normal way. There is no way I should be able to walk through walls and live outside time and be a little bit immortal, but I am. And so this is not an area where logic and, let's face it, basic biology have any part to play. In any case, time is constantly creating the future. The future contains things that didn't exist in the past. A small baby should be easy for something, someone, that rebuilds the universe once every instant. Susan sighed. And you had to remember that time probably wasn't time, in the same way that death wasn't exactly the same as death and war wasn't exactly the same as war. She'd met war. A big, fat man with an inappropriate sense of humor and a habit of repeating himself. And he certainly didn't personally attend every minor fracas. She disliked pestilence, who gave her funny looks, and famine was just wasted and weird. None of them ran their, call it, their discipline. They personified it. Given that she'd met the Tooth Fairy, the Soul Cake Duck, and Old Man Trouble, it amazed Susan that she had grown up to be mostly human, nearly normal. As she stared at her notes, her hair unwound itself from its tight bun and took up its ground state position, which was that of someone who had just touched something highly electrical. It spread out around her head like a cloud, with one black streak of nearly normal hair. Grandfather might be an ultimate destroyer of worlds and the final truth of the universe, but that wasn't to say he didn't take an interest in the little people. Perhaps time did, too. She smiled. Time waited for no man, they said. Perhaps she'd waited for one. Once. Susan was aware that someone was looking at her, turned, and saw the death of rats peering through the lens of the glasses that a mildly distracted man was searching for on the other side of the room. Up on a long, disregarded bust of a former historian, the raven preened himself. "Well," he said.
"Squeak."
"Oh, he is he?" The doors of the library were nuzzled open, and a white horse walked in. There is a terrible habit among horsey people to call a white horse gray, but even one of that bow-legged fraternity would have had to admit that this one, at least, was white. Not as white as snow, which is a dead white, but at least as white as milk, which is alive. His bridle and reins were black, and so was the saddle, but all of them were, in a sense, just for show. If the horse of death was inclined to let you ride him, then you'd stay on, saddle or no. And there was no upper limit to the amount of people he could carry. After all, plagues sometimes happened suddenly. The historians paid him no attention. Horses did not walk into libraries. Susan mounted. There were plenty of times when she wished she'd been born completely human and wholly normal. She'd give up all the immortality tomorrow, apart from Binky. A moment later, four hoofprints glowed like plasma in the air above the museum and faded away.
The crunch, crunch of the Yeti's feet over the snow and the eternal wind of the mountains were the only sounds. Then Lobsang said, "By cut off his head, you actually mean..."
"Sever the head from the body," said Lutzer.
"And," said Lobsang, still in the tones of one carefully exploring every aspect of the haunted cave, "he doesn't mind?"
"Wow, it's a nuisance," said the Yeti. "A bit of a party trick, but it's okay if it helps. The sweeper has always been a good friend to us. We owe him favors."
"I've tried teaching him the way," said Lutzer proudly.
"Yes, very useful. A washed pot never boils," said the Yeti.
Curiosity vied with annoyance in Lobsang's head and won. "What have I missed here?" he said. "You don't die?"
"I don't die, with my head cut off, for laughing, ho, ho," said the Yeti. "Of course I die, but this is not such a sizable transaction."
"It took us years to work out what the Yetis were up to," said Lutzer.
"Their loops played hop with the mandala until the abbot worked out how to allow for them. They've been extinct three times."
"Three times, eh?" said Lobsang. "That's a lot of times to go extinct. I mean, most species only manage it once, don't they?" The Yeti was now entering taller forests of ancient pine.
"Ah, this would be a good place," said Lutzer.
"Put us down, sir."
"And we'll chop your head off," said Lobsang weakly.
"What am I saying? I'm not going to chop anyone's head off."
"But you heard him say it doesn't bother him," said Lutzer, as they were gently lowered to the ground.
"That's not the point," said Lobsang hotly.
"But it's his head," Lutzer pointed out.
"But I mind."
"Oh, well, in that case," said Lutzer, "is it not written, if you want a thing done properly, you've got to do it yourself?" "Yes, it is," said the Yeti.
Lutzer, 800 years old. He has an apprentice. I have learned this. but I cannot feel him. I cannot sense him. He is the one. Binky will take you to the monk. You will find the child.
And then what?
I suspect he will need someone. When you have found him, let Binky go. I shall need him.
Susan's lips moved as a memory collided with a thought. To ride out, she said. Are you really talking about the apocalypse? Are you serious? No one believes in that sort of thing anymore.
I do.
Susan's jaw dropped. You are really going to do that? Knowing everything you know?
Death patted Binky on the muzzle. Yes, he said.
Susan gave her grandfather a sideways look. Hold on. There's a trick, isn't there? You're planning something, and you're not even going to tell me, right? You're not really going to just wait for the world to end and celebrate it, are you?
We will ride out.
No!
You will not tell the rivers not to flow. You will not tell the sun not to shine. You will not tell me what I should and should not do.
But it's so... Susan's expression changed, and Death flinched. I thought you cared.
Take this also.
Without wanting to, Susan took a smaller lifetimer from her grandfather.
She may talk to you.
And who is this?
The midwife, said Death. Now, find the sun.
He faded. Susan looked down at the lifetimer in her hands. He's done it to you again, she screamed at herself. You don't have to do this, and you can put this thing down, and you can go back to the classroom, and you can be normal again, and you just know that you won't, and so does he. Squeak. The Death of Rats was sitting between Binky's ears, grasping a lock of the white mane with the general impression of someone anxious to be going. Susan raised a hand to slap him off, and then stopped herself. Instead, she pushed the heavy lifetimer into the rat's paws. Make yourself useful, she said, grasping the reins and mounting up. Why do I do this? Squee. I have not got a nice nature.
There was not, surprisingly, a great deal of blood. The head rolled into the snow, and the body slowly toppled forward. Now you killed! Lobsang began. Just a second, said Lutzer. Any moment now. The headless body vanished. The kneeling Yeti turned his head to Lutzer, blinked, and said, That stung a bit. Sorry. Lutzer turned to Lobsang. Now, hold on to that memory, he commanded. It'll try to vanish, but you've had training. You've got to go on remembering that you saw something which now did not happen, understand? Remember the time's a lot less unbending than people think, if you get your head right. Just a little lesson. Seeing is believing. How did it do that? Good question. They can save their life up to a certain point and go back to it if they get killed, said Lutzer. How it's done? Well, the abbot spent the best part of a decade working that one out. Not that anyone else can understand it. There's a lot of quantum involved. He took a pull of his permanent foul cigarette. Gotta be good working out, if no one else can understand it.
The Yeti of the Ramtops, where the Discworld's magical field is so intense that it is part of the very landscape, are one of the few creatures to utilize control of personal time for genetic advantage. The result is a kind of physical premonition. You find out what is going to happen next by allowing it to happen. Faced with danger or any kind of task that involves risk of death, a Yeti will save its life up to that point and then proceed with all due caution, yet in the comfortable knowledge that should everything go pancake-shaped, it will wake up at the point where it saved itself with, and this is the important part, knowledge of the events which have just happened, but which will not happen now because it's not going to be such a damn fool next time. Now, this is not quite the paradox it appears because, after it has taken place, it hasn't happened. All that actually remains is a memory in the Yeti's head, which merely turns out to be a remarkably accurate premonition. The little eddies in time caused by all this are just lost in the noise of all the kinks, dips, and knots put in time by every other living creature.
"How is the abbot these days?" said the Yeti, getting to its feet again and picking up the pilgrim.
"Teething. Ah, reincarnation's always a problem," said the Yeti, falling into its long, ground-eating lope. "Teeth are the worst," he says. "Always coming or going."
"How fast are we going?" said Lobsang. The Yeti's stride was more like a continuous series of leaps from one foot to the other. There was so much spring in the long legs that each landing was a mere faint rocking sensation. It was almost restful.
"Well, you reckon we're doing 30 miles an hour or so, clock time?" said Blutzer. "Get some rest. We'll be above Copperhead in the morning. It's all downhill from there."
"Coming back from the dead," Lobsang murmured.
"It's more like not actually ever going in the first place," said Lutzer. "I studied the technique a bit, but, well, unless it's built in, you have to learn how to do it. And would you want to bet on getting it right first time? Tricky one. You'd have to be desperate. I hope I'm never that desperate."
End of side 8.